trip to the month of
And tonight he will be sharing his story and steps 1 and 2, and that's Dennis R. from Freehold.
Hi, everybody. My name is Dennis Robbins, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Dennis.
I want to thank Mike. Thanks a lot, Mike, for asking me to come up. And I want to thank the Caritas Message Group of Alcoholics Anonymous for the privilege of being here. I also want to thank those guys that took the trip over to me from Freehold and Lady, my two buddies that live up in this area, and all those that I do know, all those that I'm going to meet while I'm here. My home group is the Community Special Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I believe it's the best group in Alcoholics Anonymous. Service group. They believe in carrying the message of love and hope to people in institutions. That's where I make my home. My sobriety day is September 27, 1984. And I'm just really just happy to be here. I kind of feel at home, man. You're a real comfortable feeling, right? I'm going to try to tell you in a general way what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like today. I've always been fascinated by booze since I was a little boy. My parents used to take me to my uncle's house in Brooklyn or in the Bronx. And I used to watch people drink. And drinking just fascinated me. You know, I was kind of a kid who kind of observed people. I was always watching people. And I was also an ornery kid who was told to stay in the room. I was always the one that came back out. And after a while, they'd get tired of telling me to stay where I was. And I would sit up on their laps. And I'd see that red eyes and the stinking breath, and that just was right in my element. I just loved it. But what used to fascinate me was when they started drinking. You know, they would be friendly, they would be talking. Then after quite a few drinks, their crescendo, their voices would start to raise up. You know, it was almost like they would start to shout at each other. And what I learned today, they were trying to out-talk each other. And what really came about after that, not too soon after that, maybe an argument would break out. And maybe not too soon after that, we'll fight. And it just fascinated me as a little boy just to watch that. And I couldn't wait to get my hands on the stuff. Well, so I started drinking early. I used to pick up drinks when I was about 9, 10 years old after parties. My mother and father would be sleeping. I used to sip out the glasses. My father turned his back and I would drink out of beer cans. And that's basically where it was from. One of the things that kind of fascinates me today, I didn't think it was a problem then, but I know it was the cause of my underlying ism. I believe ever since I first began to think, I wanted what I wanted when I wanted it. That was just my nature. You couldn't tell me a thing. You know, I liked excitement too. My excitement just turned me on. I preferred living in the Bronx, being in the Bronx at my godmother's house, more than being in Queens in a nice, real quiet neighborhood. Both my mother and father had fantastic jobs, and they wanted the very best for me. They sent me to the best schools, they dressed me the best. I had everything you could ask for. Another thing that I noticed about me, and it's very characteristic of my behavior, is I was never satisfied. Never satisfied. I got a new scooter. After a while, if I saw another guy with a scooter with a box and a 2x4 and 2 skates nailed to it, I wanted that. Never satisfied. Never satisfied. I was a good kid in school. I got good grades. I shouldn't say I was a good kid. I got good grades, but I was the type of kid who was always getting sent down to the principal. You know, my mother and father would always come up to school and especially my mother would always come to school and the principal would say, all right, we'll let him go, and I got away with a lot. I started getting a little older, and about 15 years old, I started getting into trouble. A friend of mine was carrying a weapon on him, and we were two black kids running around a neighborhood in Jamaica, by Jamaica High School. The cop saw us, and he panicked and started running, and I ran with him. And they got out the car and chased us, and he dropped something on the curb, and they found it. And the cop went up both sides of our heads with a nightstick, and took his boat down to the precinct. Now, what was incredible is that they found this guy had a zip gun. And I don't know what happened to him, but my mother came and got me out of that precinct. And from that point on, I thought I was invulnerable. I thought I was invulnerable. At that point, my grades dropping and starting to get in trouble a lot, she thought it'd be better I moved upstate to a place called Rome, New York. 50,000 people, all they did was move the problem from one area to the other. That's all they really did. I got up there and I started meeting people just like me, people like to drink. You know, I was gifted. God gave me a lot of gifts. I ran track, I played football, I went out to sports. Drinking was to be ruinous of my performance. Just to illustrate a little bit more of my thinking at about 16 years old, on the football team, on the sidelines, if I wasn't playing, I was rooting for the other team to win. Now, if that's not a description of a large ego, I don't know what is. But eventually, I did wind up playing a lot. And when I was in the game, of course, I wanted to win. I wanted everybody to win. One of the things up there, too, I met my girlfriend, and she played the piano in church, because I went to church every Sunday. See, that was my mother's solution for me. They thought that that would be the thing that would straighten me out. And I went every Sunday. And I met her, and I went home with her, and we became good friends. And I noticed one thing, her mother drank. Now, I don't know about here, but I know up there, kids can go to the liquor store. You're 16, you can go to the liquor store and pick up booze for your parents if they call ahead to get it. And she would bring back that liquor to her mother and the Wilson's and Four Roses. You know, she would give me a sip of that. It would burn me from the time it hit my lips to the time it hit the bottom of my belly. And I didn't like the way it tasted. Whatever she offered to me, I never said no. I never said no. You know, I started to go downhill slowly, especially in sports. About 15 and a half years old, 16, somewhere around there, we had a track meet in Watertown. And the night before, a friend of mine named Mickey handed me a bottle of wine. And I'm a gulper. I don't know what it's like to sip nothing. Even today, I have to watch the way I drink water and soda, because if I'm not careful, I could drown myself. You know, I just drink fast. You know, and he gave me that and went down, and it was warm, and I felt mellow, and it was like in the evening, and the lights were looking different, and I remember smiling. I remember smiling out to him. He asked me what was so funny. And I said, man, this feels good. Give me some more of that stuff. And I drank some more. And right after that, I threw up. My body had rejected it. And I eventually became a perpetual puke. I threw up a lot in the morning. I thought drinking and throwing up were synonymous. I thought if you did one, the other was bound to happen. I had a track meet the next day up in Watertown, and we got on the bus and we rode up there, and man, I was nursing a hangover that you would never believe. Got left at the blocks in the sprints, messed up the relay team, and my coach asked me what was the matter, and I began to lie. I told him, I said, I didn't get no sleep last night. What I had to really tell him, I was nursing a hangover from Rome up to Watertown. It just took me down. It just started to take me down. I graduated from high school and went out to a school out in Indiana, a small school out in Muncie. I was 17 years old, drinking age was 21, I managed to drink just as much as everybody else. I got involved with people out there that drank, the fraternity people who were a lot older than me. I went out for football there, I got cut. I went out for track, I didn't perform well. I was chasing women all over the state of Indiana. I would call my mother from South Bend, I'd call her from Indianapolis. She said, well, I thought you were in school. What really wound up happening after the first year, I flunked out. And when I got home, my mother told me I wasn't no damn good. She wasn't going to waste any more money on me. And that's basically what I wanted to hear. I got my first major job at Bendix Aviation in Utica, New York. I was about 18 and a half, almost 19. I was a metallurgical lab technician. I got paid every 2 weeks, and I made a lot of money for a kid my age. But if I can look back now, I had the problem right then. because 4 days prior to payday, I would be asking the cafeteria manager if I could get my lunch on credit. I never had no money. I was always broke. You know, my days and nights consisted of drinking in the six bars on Liberty Street, Utica, driving the 21 miles back to Rome, New York, drinking in the top hat at the Circle Bar, losing watches, getting in the fights, the same insanity, over and over and over again. I went down to New York to visit my mother. Coming back on New York State Freeway, I found myself on an exit ramp, doing about 45 miles an hour. The car was rolling. I remember holding the wheel, the car was rolling, I came to. Now, I didn't go into any ravine, I didn't hit no trees, I didn't hit no rocks. And I don't know no car that drives itself. And I have to tell you that, looking back, I'm here by the grace of God. I literally passed out at the wheel. Literally went to sleep. Now, mothers against drunk driving like me to do qualification, but I always drove with half a pint of blackberry brandy and vodka because I wanted the trip to go by mellow. See, I like driving like being mellow. You know, made the trip go by fast, by better. But see, what I didn't realize is I was getting in a lot of accidents. I was getting a lot of speeding tickets. I was getting a lot of trouble with my driving. Alcohol was causing it. I got laid off from Bendix Aviation. I started working for a phone company in 1963. And I, upstate, you know, when you live in a small town, to get excited, you go to Albany, you go to Syracuse, you go to big cities, because that's what they were today. And, you know, you're going in, you're going in the bars, you're drinking constantly, and you're getting drunk, you're blacking out. You're waking up in strange places with different people and strange people, people you don't know, and things happen. I transferred down to New York, and I was on the job, and two big, tall men came on my job, and they asked my boss, where's Dennis Roberts? He said, he's right over there. They said, son, can you come with us for a few minutes? We'd like to talk to you outside. So I went outside, and I talked to him. And they said, you know, we have a warrant out for you. I said, you have a warrant out for me? They said, yeah, it's a warrant. We're not going to put you in jail. We just want you to answer the warrant. Go up to Albany and answer. But if you don't, we're going to come back and we're going to get you and go lock you up. So I went up to Albany. I knew what I was going to do. It was a paternity warrant. I went up to the courthouse, and the social worker and the girl were there, and brought the baby out. When I looked at that baby, it was like I was looking at me. And I told that woman, I said, you know, that's your boyfriend's kid. That's not mine. Always in denial. Always blaming somebody else. So finally, the social worker asked me what I wanted to do. And I talked to her. And we wound up putting the baby up for adoption. When I got back down to New York, my mother told me I ought to be ashamed of myself. She said, you weren't raised that way. You were raised better than that. What's the matter with you? And all you had to do was just give me one drink. And I didn't care what she said. I didn't care what she doing. It didn't matter to me. I didn't want nothing to come in between me and my drink and me and my party. I went to a service in 1966. And the only thing I'll talk about the service, I went to jump school before Benning in 1967. I couldn't drink there, couldn't drink in the jump area, but when I left there and went to Fort Bragg for my training, the guys would come back to Vietnam, they were in the barracks, drinking booze, smoking dope, and I was right in there with them. You know, to this day, I wonder how I made revenue, because I stayed drunk. I used to go to the EM Club and drink my heart out. Then when I got promoted, I went to the NCO Club and drank even more. I don't know how I got through the training I got through. I really don't know how I did it, but I did it. You know, when you're young, I guess you can do these things. But I don't know today how I managed to get through that. I went to Vietnam in 1968. I had married that young lady that played the piano, and that was so that we can get some more money while I was going to Vietnam. I mean, I loved it, but it was also a financial thing. You know, they pay you more money when you marry. I went to Vietnam in 1968, June, and the only thing I want to talk about Vietnam is that when I was up in the Tu Corps up in the mountains with the mountain yards, and those were mainly our troops, because I was in Special Forces. We trained mountain yards, and and the Vietnamese special forces and that. The Montagnards used to make rice wine, and they used to make it in tall vats. Now remember, before we went over there, they said, don't drink the water. Don't drink the water. If you drink the water, you have to purify it with iodine tablets. Well, I never dropped no iodine tablets in that rice wine because that's where they got that water from the rivers. Now, guys were getting medevaced with hepatitis and all kind of stuff. And the only thing that stuff did, I hope they never import that stuff over here, because it would make a lot of you sick. Because it made me sick. It used to give me violent headaches. It used to give me diarrhea. I would almost drink it and urinate out my behind at the same time. It was almost that instant. You know, and I would tell them, now I would get angry. I almost want to shoot him. And the thing about it, well, here's the insanity. Whenever I found out they would make another batch, I would go back and say, give me some more of that stuff. Always think it'd be different next time. I drank a lot of Jack Daniels over there, Jack Daniels and Coke. Used a lot of lime juice. We didn't have no food over there, so you had to use juice. Did a lot of dextrose-amphetamines. When I was out in the field, I did not drink. Now, where I was, I had to stay alert. So I used a lot of speed to stay up. Came back, and I remember going out. One of the guys on my team had gotten killed, and my team sergeant asked me to go out there with him to bring him back, and he was going to take over the operation. And I remember when he came off operation, he said to me, he came to the team house, he said, come here, I want to talk to you. And he said that you should pray every day for the rest of your life, because you shouldn't be here. I don't know how you people in that helicopter survived. We just knew you were going to crash. Because it was raining, a lot of wind was blowing, and but Bruce made me forget that. Bruce made me forget that. I came home in 1969, my girlfriend had transferred from the phone company from Utica down to New York, my wife and I. We lived in a beautiful development in Left Rock City in Queens. I mean, really, really beautiful in 69. I mean, immaculate. Friends of mine used to ask me, well, how'd you wind up in there? I said, I don't know. I just wound up in there. You know, it seems as though when anybody tried to do me any good, I just went the opposite way. I had a problem accepting good. You know, I started not to really like the neighborhood because it was there weren't too many of us there. And none of the bars, we had a local bar there on the corner called Heads and Tails, but there wasn't that much activity. It was quiet. You know, it was quiet and sedate. And all you hear was glass tinklings. And I wanted noise. You know, so what I did was I used to go down to Avenue D to Little More Projects with my friends. I was in the service bureau, Bedford-Stuyvesant, Brooklyn, and I'd go in the bars, man, where to hear yourself, you had a shot. You know, the more noise there was, the more activity, and jukebox as high as it can go, and people running each other, I just loved the atmosphere. It just turned me on. You know, I just loved it. I could have moved in there. You know, so much, you know, and I remember she used to tell me, well, you know, Friday night is your night out. And I'm going to let you have that because you're all right. And then it became Saturday night, Sunday night. You know, at times I forgot I was even married. I would just go out and just continue drinking and just continue with my friends. Now, I wasn't really doing anything. I wasn't really cavorting at that time. You know, but when I came home one day, my wife looked at me and she said, you know, she never really called me Dennis that much. She had a lot of names for me. You know, I don't know. They weren't nice. But one day she hit me with something that really chased me to the dictionary. She said, you know, you're a whoremonger. And I said, I don't know what the hell that is. She said, that's just what you are. Well, she thought I was out there running around the street with all the women. So I looked it up in the dictionary and I said, well, if that's what you believe, then that's what I'm going to do. You know, and I would go out and come back. Sometimes I would stay home. Now, if you have two people in the same house, and they're both drinking, you got problems. She used to drink her Johnny Walker Red, and I'd drink my vodka. And she'd be over there by the bar, just minding her business. And she'd sit in front of the TV, minding mine. And it seemed like the more she drank, the more vocal she got. Now, I was just the opposite. The more I drank, the quieter I got. And I would sit there watching TV, minding my own business. Now, she would bring up stuff that happened months and years ago. you know, she would just like start and a lot of other words I don't want to say at the podium. Don't you remember this? Don't you remember that? And you know, my mother used to tell me, you know, when people are arguing with you, just be quiet. Because after a while, they'll burn themselves out. Well, she didn't. You know, it seemed like the quieter I got, the more angry she got. And then she started throwing things. And even to this day, I don't like nobody throwing nothing at me, you know. And after a while, the cops would come to the door. There'd be physical, verbal fights. You know, things I'm not proud of. But that's what alcohol does to two people who are drinking. I remember times when I used to get on the phone and, you know, she used to tell her brothers, you know, I'm down here. And I used to get on the phone and invite her brothers down here by plane. I'll pay your way down here. Now, you know, when you're drinking and you're feeling good, you know, and I was, you know, all these airborne things came back and I felt like I was, you know, king of the world. Now, Sonny and Leon were both about 6'3". You know, if they got that plane, Candy, they probably would have wiped me out. You know, but my mind would, if you don't like, come on down here. You know, that's what alcohol did to me. That's just what alcohol did. You know, I was one day watching Bathroom in the Rug. I had secretly got an apartment in the same complex in a different building. And I walked out. I left it. Now, I was sober a little bit over 2 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was to go back and make amends to her and her family. Because when you involve these steps in your life, the truth comes out. The very truth of your being comes out. And I remember talking to her mother, and her mother told me, she said, you know, you almost caused my daughter a nervous breakdown. And I don't ever want to hurt anybody like that ever again. See, I didn't think I was bothering anybody with my drinking. If I wasn't there, how was I bothering you? You know, but when people are worried about you, it causes stress. See, these things never entered my mind because I was too self-centered. Too self-absorbed with me and what I wanted. That behavior really magnified when I drank. And of course, the breakup of that marriage was not a fault. It was my fault. I told my mother that. And even though I was married to somebody else at the time, her mother invited me back up to Rome to visit them anytime I was back in the area. And I owe that to Alcoholics Anonymous. I owe that to Alcoholics Anonymous. And even to this day, she's retired from the phone. Maybe every once in a while I hear from her, maybe once a year, twice a year, she'll tell me how she's doing. You know, and I married somebody else. And I met my present wife, and I put her through 10 years of living hell. 10 years of living hell. In 1976, my mother called me on the telephone, and I had an uncle that drank a lot, my Uncle Freddie. Now, if you're looking, if you know Freddie, I'm Freddie. Only Freddie's 6'3". We look almost identical. And he used to drink, and he used to do his business up in the Bronx, and I used to tell him, you know, you ought to stop it because it's going to wind up killing me. And he would have me go to the liquor store and buy him booze, and I'd come back and just get just as drunk as he was. And I'd be telling him, you need to cut it out, Freddie. And I'd be just as drunk, if not drunker. And my mother called me at work, and she said, I got a call from one of his neighbors that his door was open. So I left work. Very casual. I went to OTB and played a few horses, went to the bar and got a few drinks. Mosey on up to the Bronx. I got up there. He lived in a walk-up. When I got to the second floor and I saw the door was ajar, I walked through a flat at the end of the hallway. I saw my uncle on his knees, butt naked, reaching for a telephone. He had hemorrhaged blood all over the place. Alcohol. I remember when the body people came to get him. I remember, and they really take their time too in New York. They're not going to rush to do that. And I had to sit there with that body for a couple of hours, and I was just devastated because I loved him a lot. He was my idol. He loved to drink. He had a lot of women. He did everything illegal. I just loved him. he was my man. I remember when the body people came and got him, I remember telling my mother, that won't happen to me. And right before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, the same thing almost happened to me. Again, I'm here by the grace of God. I had a son born in 1976, later that year. And maybe for about the first 2 or 3 months, maybe I was a decent father, maybe. I remember I used to put him on my back, in one of these backpacks, man. I used to ride him on my back. And I really bonded with him very, very well. Then I became irritable, restless, and discontent. I need to drink. And as a little boy, he would come to the door, Daddy, I'll be right back. But you and I know when we pick up the first drink, we don't know when we're coming back. And after a while, he stopped coming to the door. My descent was slowly going downhill. Now, in 1979, I had an opportunity that was incredible. There was a problem with the phone systems out in California, and they were looking for volunteers to go work in San Francisco. So I volunteered to go. I worked out in San Francisco from December of 79 to April 1st of 80. And I felt like I was in paradise. Because out there in San Francisco, you could buy booze in the supermarket, in the candy store. You could buy booze everywhere. And out there, the Corbells was cheap. You know, the Hennessy and the wines, that wine country rapture, everything was cheap. And I stayed drunk. You know, and I came home by plane every third weekend. They would fly me. I had a ride. Every third weekend, I was going back and forth. And my coach ticket coming to New York, when I was going back to San Francisco at night at 8:30, it became first class. I don't know if any of you rode first class, but there's a lot of booze in first class. You know, and man, I used to tell them, just line them up, man. And they used to almost have to carry me off the airplane. Literally carry me off the airplane. I'd be so messed up. I had a ride. I made so much money, they couldn't even time it in New York. They thought they was lying out there. I was at the top of the world. So I came back home in 1980, and all that I'd saved, all that I'd done, just went to New York. I mean, it was cascading further and further down. They would send me off on business trips, and I was a happy hour freak. I loved happy hour. You know, you can eat a few chicken bones and, you know, a few wings and whatnot and drink to your heart's content. Now, when I go out on these escapades, I was sent to learn something. But I never learned nothing. I would have to come back and scramble and read these books and get myself, because when I never learned nothing when I was out there those 3 or 4 days. You never learned nothing. Didn't learn nothing. I stay out. You know, and my descent was very, very fast at the end. I started not paying rent. My rent got backed up. There were times when I had to run an extension cord out to the hallway to plug into them because they had turned my lights out. Very little food in the house. And I made a lot of money. Now, at this time, I was falling uphill. That means, for some reason or another, I was getting promotions. I don't know what they liked about me, but I mean, when I was there, I worked good. But when I was, a lot of times I wasn't there. And towards the end, a 4 week vacation, I was out of vacation time around the end of March. Because I used it all up. You know, I couldn't get to work, so I would use it up. And I remember them coming into work one day and telling me, you got to go home. Because I remember that night, got drunk coming in, laying down on the desk. The guy said, the only reason why we knew you were alive because we saw your nose flaring. And we saw you breathing. We thought you would die. When I came to, a woman came, see, I came here to relieve you. You got to go home. And I said to myself, I'm going to straighten myself up. I was back drinking that night. Just like I'd never stopped. I couldn't stop drinking. The lights were getting turned out. The rent was not getting paid. Very little food in the house. I become a manager at the phone company. I was even getting my phone shut off. Now, you know, when you get your phone shut off, you're in trouble. I mean, You know, I call the business office and I tell them, don't you know who I am and all this thing? Hey, you told us that a month ago. Why don't you pay your bill? And I would wind up, borrowing money from my mother. Well, my mother was a great enabler. My apartment became my mother's old house. When my mother went from my house to my house, it was like going to an old house. Because she gave me couches and curtains. I didn't think necessary for me to buy it. I mean, it was good stuff. That's how responsible I was. That's how irresponsible I had become due to the use of alcohol. There are many things that I can really tell you about my alcoholism. The blackouts, not finding a car, getting beat up in bars, getting a gun stuck to my head. But I'll save you all of that. It was just a descent into an absolute living hell. There were times when I would say to myself, this is not right, I should go home. But as soon as I took a drink, it made everything all right what I was doing. Immediately. What little sense of God that was still in me, I literally washed it down with booze. And after a while, whatever that was coming up, didn't come up anymore. And I was just merely existing out there. Merely existing. I heard it said you can be at the top rung of the ladder and you have arrived. But each rung of the ladder that you come down, you become satisfied with who you are. You become satisfied when you have holes in your shoes. You stitch your pants up just so that people don't see it. Baths of cologne, not soap and water, but just a few splash cologne, I must smell okay. My boss is going into the bathroom knocking on the door. Aren't you, when you're coming out of there, I go in there just to sit down just to get maybe 1 minute sleep. It was insanity, absolute insanity. Well, that's what it was like. But let me tell you what happened. And what happened is the earmark of my whole story, because if I just remember what happened, I don't have to worry about God. Because it was something that happened to me one Sunday morning, I had my power. I had taken a young man, maybe back from my house, a woman I brought to my house to seduce her. She started talking about her higher power. And I said to my friends, what the hell, I said to myself, what the hell did I do this for? What did I get myself into here? She said, if you don't know how to pray, I'll pray for you. And she evidently did. And I know my mother was praying full time. Well, I took her back to the Bronx and brought her home. Came back home. And I went to sleep. Now, I didn't have no weird dreams. I didn't see no lights, no flashes. Nothing out of the ordinary. I came to that Sunday morning, and I just didn't want it. If an alcoholic of my type, just to make that statement, I'm not talking nothing short of a miracle. I couldn't stop drinking. I couldn't even stop thinking about it. But what I thank God so much for is the immense amount of pain that was left in this week. Because that was the motivator. I went to my bosses that Monday morning, and I said to them, Eddie, I think I'm losing my mind. And they said, we could have told you that a long time ago. What do you want to do about it? I said, I need help. Now, I thought I was going to go to a mental institution, padded walls, where they'd give you shock treatments. It took me right upstairs to medical on the 13th floor. No appointments, no nothing. Straight up the elevator. There was a guy named Dick, and I may rest in peace. It was an EAP. And he said, son, what's the matter? I said, I can't stop drinking. I don't know where the honesty came from. I never been to somebody that drank too much. He said, we're going to give you a set of questions here we'd like you to answer. We want you to be very truthful if you can be truthful. I got them all right. I got 100. And he said, we want to send you away to a treatment center. And I said, well, wait a minute, I can't go right now. But I will go at the end of the week. He said, no. He said, we're going to send you just like you are. Go home, pack. Don't pack no, just send me straight here. I said, please. I got to take care of some business. My wife had left me. Little boy had left me. Her job told me not to call her anymore. If they would, they would call the police on me. My mother hadn't heard from her about 4 or 5 days. And after about the 5th or 6th day, she did call me and said, I have to let you see your son, but I don't have anything else having to do with you again in life. And then she began to tell me what I was like in blackouts. How I wake up in the middle of the night screaming at her and my son take off. And I can remember driving, you know, going to Manhattan, going over Long Island Express in Manhattan. I can remember saying I should go back, but I couldn't go back. I would go back, I'd go right to the bars, right to the after hour, try to go to work. I mean, it was just a constant cycle. I couldn't get out of it. And, but she said, I'll let you see your son at your mother's house, but I won't be there. And if I can remember the look I saw in my son's eyes, he's about 4 years old. I can't drink again a day at a time. I can't drink. But I saw a look of hope and despair. I saw me crying in his eyes. I can't describe it, but I just can't drink again a day at a time. I went to my friend Vinny's house. He said, get a shot of cognac and take a blow. And as soon as I did, I can get down. I don't care if she'll never come back. I had a good friend of mine that moved in with me, was a coke dealer, and drinking and partying and all that stuff. But right in the midst of a lot of that, I began to cry a lot. I remember Dick said, we're going to send you away to a treatment center. And I went that Saturday morning. My mother and father drove me out to Pennsylvania. And I remember there was a little sign on the wall, and it said, today is the first day for the rest of your life. My mother's next statement was, you better pay attention that sign. And I did. Not only was the gift given to me of the mental obsession being taken away, and the pain left to motivate me, but he also gave me another gift of surrender, because when I got there, I never forgot. I think when I got there, I did tell him one time, I want to try to come out of running this place. They told me to sit down and shut up. And they gave me a big book. Because everybody in that treatment center was an AA member. From the gardens all the way up down to the people around the place was an AA. And the thing about the big book that I'm going to talk about is that when I first began to read it, I would read a paragraph and forget what I read. I couldn't comprehend anything. I said, oh my God, I ruined my brain. Now, I've gone back to school under GI Bill and graduated from Queens College, and I believe I graduated the lowest person in my class. And maybe I graduated lower than me, had to be an alcoholic or drug addict. I was right at the bottom. Just barely got out by the skin of my teeth. Just to satisfy a whim that I had and something that my mother wanted me to do. And I remember going to college drunk. I used to go there and try to see if I could comprehend with a buzzer on, you know, that kind of nonsense. It was just insane. You know, and I would read that paragraph and I would forget what I read. I remember a counselor saying, well, start jotting down things as you read them. And then things began to come to me. But I'd read it and then I'd forget. I'd read it and I'd forget. But I kept doing what they told me to do. I started to open up. I started to share. I started to listen to the people that came in with the AA meetings, and I started to pay attention. I started to identify. We would go out to meetings in the area, and I would identify with them. And the last paragraph of chapter 3 in the middle. Kind of like the spiritual experience for me, it literally came off the page. It was almost as if it was being read to me. It says, at certain times, the alcoholic has no effect on them because he has the first drink. In such rare cases, neither he nor other human being can reduce such a defense. That defense must come from a higher power. And my question at that point was to find that power. I've been a student of the Big Book ever since. I got home, went to my first meeting was at Roseville Hospital, Winston Group. On one side, they were in slippers and robes, and the other side, they were jumping up and down, having a good time. Guy was celebrating 10 years. I was in the right place. My wife said, you come out and visit us in Brooklyn, but you can't stay. So when I got out there, I went out there and saw her and my boy. They had a nice bottom half of single family home. Bottom half of a two family home, I might say. And I told her, I'm in AA. She said, that's nice. But you're not staying here. And I cried all the way from Brooklyn back to Queens. I cried all the way back. But I didn't drink. I got rid of all the drug paraphernalia. I got rid of all the booze, all the vanilla extract, everything that pertained to alcohol in my house. And the guy that was staying with me, I said, "You're going to have to move. My wife is coming back." My wife had no intention of coming back, so I had to lie to her. That wasn't me. That wasn't me doing that, because I love partying. And I remember guys would run up to me in the street. They would say, "Hey, Dennis, you know, I got like that." And I'd say, "I'm an A." And they would just scatter. Just start running. Just start running. I mean, it was like I had to. It was unbelievable. I met my sponsor. And I love my sponsor. And my sponsor told me, he said, "You're home. You don't have to suffer anymore." And I haven't. I haven't had my head stuck in any toilet bowls. I haven't urinated on myself. I haven't thrown up on myself. And I know I am right now. And a whole lot of my drinking, I know where I was. People had to tell me. He said there are 12 steps. You put these 12 steps in your life, you become a whole new person. After 90 days, he started carrying me around when he was speaking. At 4 months, he started carrying me around into institutions with him. Institutions have been my saving grace. Service has been my saving grace. I know Tommy can speak on that. I know y'all can too. Because I know them. And I know everybody in here has probably had some sense of service. And my man George here. You know, we've been doing this for years. I know. Service has been my saving grace. Because that's what he was. I wanted to be like him so much I tried to outdo him. I was taking commitments and going to this prison, going that way. I remember him taking me out to Rikers Island. I was about 8 months sober. He says, "I want you to dress up." I said, "Dress up to go to jail?" He said, "Yeah. Wear a suit and tie." And he took me out there. And when you get to Rikers Island, before you go across the bridge, there's a checkpoint. And when you get over the bridge, there's another checkpoint. Then when you take the bus out to the men's house of detention, there's another checkpoint. I said, "Damn, son, you do this every Sunday?" He said, "Yeah." And he kind of gave me that look like, "You're going to be doing it too." So I had my first institution meeting, where I spoke. And it was one inmate, one correction officer, and my sponsor. It was the best meeting I ever had. Best meeting I ever had. Because when I came out of there, it was a bright Sunday morning. I remember looking up in the sky and thanking God. And I said, "If I live a day at a time, you just allow me to breathe, I'll commit myself to this kind of work." And I haven't failed him to this day. I haven't failed him to this day. My commitment is to service and institutions. After a period of time, my wife invited me to stay overnight. And I go back to my sponsor and tell him, "You say anything is working." He say, "You're not here to get your wife back. You're here to stay sober." After 11 and a half months, she came back. I had nothing to do with it. I just didn't drink. I went to meetings. And I started working at alcoholics. I found out that my God heals in His time, not mine. My wife had a big job offer, a big job change, almost 14 years ago down in Freehold. And she said, "How would you like to come down and be getting a house down there?" Here's a woman that wouldn't have anything else ever to do with me again in life. All because I don't drink. I go to meetings. And I work with other alcoholics. Well, so the first step, when we admit we're powerless over alcohol, our lives have become unmanageable. There's no doubt in my mind that my life is unmanageable. I lost my wife. I lost my family. I was about to lose my job. More than that, I lost me. I'm able to see that. So unmanageability wasn't really the question. I really started to see that clearly, that my life had been for the man. It was chaos. Every day was anxiety. I know what alcohol did to me. It wound me up into a treatment center, which is really a nice name for a mental institution. And I finally came to be aware of where I actually was. But how did I find out I was proud of alcohol? Well, the big one told me. Men and women often drink for the effect produced by alcohol. Well, that's the way I drink. That's the way I drink. You know, identify with Bill's story. In chapter 2 on solutions, I identify with that one squiggly right where it says the alcoholic can't remember the pain and suffering of day or week or month ago. Well, I identify with that because I remember myself on ballroom, bathrooms and bars and piss on my knees puking in a toilet bowl, getting up saying, I'm not doing this no more. Go right outside that bathroom door and ask the bartender for a beer. Because in my drinking, I didn't think beer and wine was alcohol. I thought they were beverages. You know, chasers. You know, that kind of thing. You know, and you know, the thing about it was, how come a guy, friends of mine, used to come to the bar and he said to me, well, you're not drinking, then I'm on the wagon. I'm sitting there drinking beers and masses of rosé and all kind of wine, I'm on the wagon. You know, because in my drinking, when I really got serious drinking, it was Ron Rico 151 and vodka blue label over proof vodka. Powerless. Let me give you an illustration of how powerless I am over alcohol. My godmother, her daughter, had invited me over to the Bronx. And she said to me, here's some strawberry punch. Now, West Indians have overproof rum. They bring from the West Indies. It's, I believe if you pour it in a gas, if you pour it in a car, it'll make it run. I believe it will make it, it's like jet fuel. I mean, you can smell it throughout the whole house, but it's powerful. And what they do is they mix it with strawberry syrup. And she would hand me a glass, she said, now be careful, it's strong. And I sipped it. I drank it and I said, boy, this is good. Give me another one. She gave me another one. I sat down on the couch. About an hour and a half later, I came to and I said, what happened? And she was in the kitchen cooking and she said, I told you. And what was the first thing out of my mouth? Give me another. And she said, I'm not going to do it because you have to drive home. And I got to resent it. And I got home and started drinking again. So I realized how powerful somebody is. You know, when I read the story of the jaywalker, you know, how I identify, not being able to stop. No matter how much it hurts me, how much I hurt others, how much guilt, how much remorse, how much just insanity pervades my life, I inevitably go back to drinking. Some days I don't want to drink. Not a cloud on the horizon. Not a cloud. This is a good day. And right away I said, I got to go to the bar. I need a drink. Oh, I said, you need a drink today. Yeah, I'm going to get me a drink. And my intention was really to go in, maybe have a beer or one day. What was that the first drink I couldn't stop? They told me about that, and Dr. Pinney, I have a physical allergy. A physical compulsion and a mental obsession. That when I face the first drink, it triggers the allergy and I can't stop. I identified with that. My sponsor pointed these things out to me. I said, that's me. That's me. You know, we're more on alcoholism. You know, how I identified with the stories. And how did I come to believe that power greater than the story you said? Well, I came. After a period of time, I started to clear up. I came to. I think the turning point for me was the We Gnostics. Because outside, my concept of God was always outside of me. Always. But in there, it says, deep down every man, woman, and child, the fundamental idea of God. You search within, you'll find them. My God. And my sponsor said to me, he said, well, when you came to that Sunday morning, and you don't want it anymore, who do you think that was? I haven't had a problem with God ever since. I know I didn't stop it. I know you didn't stop it. But you keep me stopped. Because I make meetings every day. Every day. That's the only thing, my sponsor did tell me at the beginning too. He says, how often did you drink? I said, I drink every day. He said, well, you go to meetings every day. I said, I've been doing it ever since. For some reason or another, And it fathoms me to even think about it. I never fought the program. In all my life, I fought everything. I fought everything and everybody. I fought during my training when I was a grad through Special Forces in Vietnam. I was taught any situation is just a situation. You're not supposed to be afraid. Well, that's a lie. You get afraid when people shoot at you. But I tell you the truth, it's kind of like a brainwashing. And I always thought that I could stop myself. I would say when I'm 35, I'll quit. My son's next birthday, that's it. I mean it. 39 for sure. Come to find out, I didn't stop me. The power greater than myself stopped. So like I said, I came to believe that power greater can restore insanity. In that, I wasn't repeating the same behaviors over and over and over again. I didn't like bars anymore. Look, you could have sent me mail to the bars in my neighborhood and sent them after hours. I'm not meant that. That's how often I was there. But all of a sudden, I didn't like bars anymore. I didn't like being around people like that anymore. You know, and I believe coming to meetings on a daily basis. You know, because I go through emotional periods, I go through self-induced drama some days in my life, and other days they're just as incredible as they can be. April 1st, 2002, this year, I retired from the phone company after 38 and a half years. The same job that was about to fire me 18 years ago is paying me a tremendous pension today. All through the grace of God and this incredible program. I remember my district secretary saying to me, she said, "How did you know when to ask for help? Because they had you written up to be fired." I said, I don't know. Now that I know. Now I know. It wasn't me. It just wasn't me. Today my life is almost beyond anything I could ever perceive, except those days when I experienced self-induced drama. You know, a guy told me one time, he said, "You know, when it gets so good you won't believe it." And I believed him. And today, I really don't believe that there's much for me to do today. I don't really worry what God's will for me today inside. I really don't worry about it. I just don't drink. I go to meetings. And I try to work with the suffering drunk, especially those in institutions. I don't believe that God charges me with much. I don't believe he charges me with much. I think he only just ask me to love today. Just love. Love my fellow man. Do the best I can for him. Do the most I can for him. Be the best I can be for that day. And that's all. I mean, I don't have that anymore. I'm pretty content with myself today. It took me a long time to get there. But I'm content. And all I can say, if you're new, if you're coming back, this is the joy of it. This is the joy. The joy is in the steps. The joy, all your answers are right here in this book. You know, I'm just so happy to have a service sponsor and a sponsor who believes in this book. The sponsor that really just showed me a new way of life. That's basically what he did. Again, I want to thank Mike. I want to thank the Charis Message Group. And I look forward to coming here the next 3 weeks. All I have, I'm not a teacher, I'm not a professor. All I have is my own experience, trying to hope on each step, and that's what I intend to share with you. So God bless you, and thank you for allowing me to be here.